You're listening to Just Ask the Question, Adventures in Reporting with your host, Brian Karam.
Hi, and welcome back to Just Ask the Question. I'm your host, Brian Karam, with our Sunday Week in Review show, Just Ask the Press. And as always, with this is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and current editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. This week, we're going to unwrap the State of the Union address. Did the media blow it again? That's a big question we want to ask. Michael's going to update us on Trump's latest court cases. We'll talk about the Super Tuesday fallout. There's nothing left in the Republican Party but MAGA. And we did, John will enlighten us a little bit on avoiding the shutdown, but what does that lead to? And, of course, there is a new port in the Middle East to try and help Palestinian survivors, and we can't miss something that was just brought up to us from a senator saying that they ought to dissolve the Senate because all the Republicans do is cater to Donnie. So we're going to unpack that, and which way is the way forward, folks? We'll find out when we come back.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not released anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. And as we begin, let's start talk a little bit about the State of the Union address given Thursday by President Joe Biden. Even some of the Republicans were admitting that he came out fiery and feisty. Those were the words that were used to describe him. At one point in time, to me, it was almost like he was holding school. He was trying to lecture. He was getting heckled by Marjorie Taylor Greene, and he's explaining to her why you need more judges, why you want to vote for the immigration bill, because it actually does what the Republicans claim they want done. But it fell on deaf ears, of course, as he continued, and he got heckled a little bit more and then fired out a little bit more about his detractors. And then closed up with, you know, the unifying remarks that he's made on all his stump speeches about this being the United States of America. Did it fall on deaf ears? What were your thoughts on that? We'll start with Michael. You heard it. Michael, what'd you think?
I think that it proves that Special Counsel Herr, who said that Biden would likely present himself in a court of law as a frail old man with a bad memory, was blown out the window because he came in as a fiery older man with a good memory, and which shows what was so bad about Herr's report. And we'll hear more about it from his testimony. But I think Biden, whether you agree with him on policies or don't agree on policies, is always a separate question of how was the performance art aspect of it, which is as important as anything else, because 50% of those people in that chamber are going to boo him, whatever he says, and the other half are going to cheer him. So how does he look? How does he sound? How does he appear? And I think on all of those fronts, he did himself well. And the question then becomes, how is that received in the public at large? You know, do they like the play, if you will? And is he now able to sustain that level of engagement and energy? Because if he does, I think he'll have helped himself enormously. If he retreats back to a Rose Garden strategy of inaccessibility, then it'll be for naught. So that's my take. But I wanted to say one thing before we turn to John Bennett, and here it is.
Yes. I can't see it. What is it? I can't hear it. I can't see it.
So what? You can't hear anything?
I can't hear it. I can't see it. That's...
Oh, man. All right. Sorry. I was playing on my cell phone. I thought you'd be able to hear it. I don't know why. Maybe it took over the sound. Was Birthday by the Beatles. One of the three of us has a birthday, right?
Well, thank you. Thank
this
you.
This very minute.
Oh, happy birthday to Brian.
I'm telling you, I'm a young guy, you know? How you doing? So, John.
Yeah, I looked on your Wikipedia page and it said 21.
That's exactly right. Well, that's just the age of my shoes. But I've got knees that are 90. John.
Well, happy birthday, Brian.
Well, yeah, thank you. Birthday. Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you, John. And so, John, State of the Union.
Well, the president said it's strong and getting stronger. That is true. The economy is actually stronger than most voters' perception of it, and he gets no credit for that, of course. The speech itself was, I'll be writing this for roll call tomorrow. I viewed it as a speech that really embodied the current political era that we're in. Republicans, you know, so I was on the Hill on Wednesday last week doing reporting for a preview story of the speech, and Republicans were telling me that they didn't think Joe Biden would be able to stand for 70 to 90 minutes, which is about where states of the union, you know, land as far as time goes. And then he delivers the speech. He's fiery. He's feisty. He's baiting them. He's arguing with them. And then Joe Biden is too angry. So he went from too frail to too angry. And my question is, in this era, what was he supposed to do? Was he supposed to go in there and give them 15 good minutes on the ins and outs of the policies of the cancer moonshot? What was he supposed to go in there and give them 8 good minutes on the policy proposals of electric vehicles? Or was he supposed to go in there and fight back against, you know, all the allegations against him? And you know, he's a competitive guy. Even at 81, I'm sure those competitive juices still rev up. And so he's not supposed to take any of this personally. And then when he's face to face, you know, confront them. This is this era of politics that we're in. This isn't Bill Clinton standing there for 2 hours going on and on about his latest policy ideas. You know, this is combat. This is in your face stuff, and it's very personal. So I don't understand the angry narrative. And that's my question, is what was he supposed to do? And so it's about what I expected from the president. You know, I thought, like you, Brian, that, you know, he showed his policy chops while also fighting back and yeah, trying to show the voters that he's up to this moment. Now, whatever this means, it was the worst received State of the Union since whatever this measure that's out there has started, the worst received. I'm not sure what that means.
I don't know what that means.
By whom, John?
By voters, by the yeah, people.
But I don't know what that means, because it reminds
me of these polls where they have like Biden or Trump's favorability rating. I don't know what that means. And you don't have to view someone favorably to vote for him. Because the other guy might be more unfavorable, yeah, whatever that means. So, long story short, I thought it was what he needed to do. And once again, it seems like I'm wrong about that, because the people didn't like the speech. They didn't like the delivery. So I'm having this cognitive dissonance.
I don't know who they are, because everyone I've talked to has said that they do like it, or they did. Even the Republicans were giving it,
yeah, I'm having, you know,
backhanded compliments on it.
Yeah, I'm trying to cover this from the front row and then give that information to voters, to the people. And I'm just not sure. I feel like I'm watching a different play or movie than the people I'm trying to get information to.
Yeah, and I feel the same way.
Very frustrating. It's becoming very frustrating.
It's huge. And we could talk a little bit about that. But I'll say that this speech, I tried to dissect the speech. I felt like if he's going to reach Trump, any Trump supporters, he's got to give them something to hope for, right? Or something and that's different than Donald Trump's fear and hatred. So right away, he picked the first thing he did out of the bat was he wasted no time with his plea of unity by reminding the world that the enemy of America is neither a Democrat nor a Republican, but Vladimir Putin. And, you know, when he shook his finger and said, if you think he'll stop at Ukraine, he will not. So that was, I think, a plea to unify people, to give them a common enemy and say, listen, you may not like Democrats, you may not like Republicans, but this guy is the antithesis of what we stand for. And then linking Donald Trump to him later only kind of drove home the idea that perhaps Donald Trump isn't what he is. But as far as the aesthetics, I thought he appeared energetic. I didn't think he shied away. Part of it was almost like some of it was Don Rickles and some of it was Jimmy Stewart. I almost expect him to say, your wonderful old savings alone, you know, when he started talking about some of the things great about America. But
we've had a Bill Clinton impression and a Jimmy Stewart. That's pretty good in the first opening.
And I liked, you know, you can't only love your country when you win was big. And then when he was talking about the facts, and he said to the Republicans, look at the facts. I know you know how to read. I mean, that was about as blunt as you could be. And so there was a lot there in the speech that I liked. But the question I have is, and it leads into what you were saying, John, is we don't know how to cover this anymore. What is the path forward in covering this stuff? Because like you just said, you feel like you're seeing one thing and there are others. How do you let the public know what it is from the front row that you saw? Because I don't think we're doing it very well. And Michael, to your point exactly, and John,
I'm sorry.
We need to see this Biden out more often. And I get tired of hearing people say that's not part of his job. It is if he wants to get reelected. Go ahead, John.
I agree with that. We do need to see this president out more often. But I wanted to ask you a question because you say this a lot. You critique the media. And you just said that we're not doing it very well. What, in your opinion, are we doing? Are we, capital W, doing wrong?
I think we are listening too much to the baseball-esque sporting type of commentary. We offer too much of that kind of punditry. And there's always, it seems to be, if not an equal-sidedness to our coverage of the news, at least less of a reliance on the facts and more of a reliance on the hyperbole of both candidates. Mm-hmm. And I think both candidates deserve scrutiny, but I believe one is probably, you know, less a criminal than the other. But I think what I look at is the lack of decent questions inside a briefing room, our subservience to a president, no matter who he is. And that bothers me. I hate seeing us cower in front of the president. We're supposed to hold him accountable. This president, the biggest, you know, complaint I have is we don't see him. When we do see him, there have been occasions when he's been very good. But this, we need to see this Joe. It wouldn't even be a contest. It really shouldn't be a contest between these two guys if we saw this Joe Biden more often. Michael?
I mean, I've said here before and then go over to Michael that, you know, on paper, Biden should be up 10 points nationally and, you know, just outside the margin in most of those swing states. But the voters, a lot of them, not all of them, have a different, they're looking at this through a different lens. And I would like to understand why, what that mindset is. But I don't know how. You could go talk to voters, but I'm not even sure you would, as a journalist, completely understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, or as a fellow human being, I don't know that I would understand. But Michael, you go ahead.
Well, I guess there are a couple of things that I think the media is doing wrong, which is, one, buying into this age issue. Yes, I hear people say, well, that's what the voters are saying, but it is become, you know, sort of the mantra of the media. Look how many people talk about age. Look how many people talk about age. And I think that age is a criterion, but what they are not doing in contrast is to say, but let's look at the policies of these two people and what they represent politically. And I think that they really need to let people understand what the vision of America and the world is that each of these candidates hold and play it out. You know, there was a book, I think was it Philip Roth's book, about what would have happened if Lindbergh beat FDR. And it's a chilling work of fiction. But we're in one of those moments. What would the world look projected out 4 years from January 2024? What will the world look like? And I think that, you know, maybe I'm naive or optimistic or some word that I can't remember.
Cognitive decline.
cognitive decline. That people will say, when understood in those terms, here is how I reevaluate or evaluate the choices I'm presented with. That's what I think. And they never are really good at, we talked about this before, when I was in independent counsel, I issued a report. It was like 300 and something pages long, maybe longer. And we have a press conference, and the press before the conference say, you know, which pages should I read? And I would say to them, you know, before we started the press conference, well, all of them, you know, it's like if you give them Crime and Punishment and they
read
say,
it.
Well, which pages should I read? You'd say, well, all of them. It's a collective whole. It's a book, you know, but no. Well, on what page? And so that they all can turn to page 62, where I say, George H.W. Bush doesn't appear to have known what was going on. That's all they want to know. They can say, write their little story. It says, independent counsel finds that George H.W. Bush probably didn't know what was going on. Thank you very much. Day done. I don't have to read the report. We don't have to talk about, well, but the context in this matters too, because context always matters. It doesn't work that way. And that's what I think we're finding here. We're just just tell me on page 62. Oh, page 62, it says Biden is older. Great. I'll just run with the older stuff. I just think there's a laziness. There's a laziness to really not uncover what the full story is in favor of what you called, Brian, the baseball. What was the final score? Yeah. The Yanks won 2-1. Great. Yanks win 2-1. But what we don't understand is, and Derek Jeter comes running over from the shortstop position to the first baseline and backflips the ball to home plate, and the guy is out in a miraculous play that saves the day, and it'll go down into the annals of baseball as one of the great plays of baseball. That doesn't get reflected in the 2-1 score. It doesn't allow the 2-1 score to be there. But if you don't understand that play, the 2-1 score is just beside the point in a way.
Well,
that's what I think we're at.
I think.
And I'm sorry for those baseball analogies.
No,
for those who don't follow baseball, go read that about that play by
read the report.
Derek Jeter.
But here's
page 62.
Before we go to break, the final thing I'll say on that is that we are intellectually lazy. We are the press is covered the State of the Union as if it were a baseball game again. I thought that we completely don't understand. We don't understand the issues. Many of the people in the White House briefing room are not that experienced or knowledgeable of the issues that they cover. You know this, John. I mean, you've seen it. I would say at the end of the day, we got to get better at doing our job, but that does not give, and this is my biggest complaint about the Biden administration again, is it doesn't give them cover for not putting their word out more often. That's on them.
There is definitely, and I've mostly from afar, for right now, observing this, the White House briefing, there has been a youth movement in the White House press corps. And I'm not in those newsrooms. I'm not in those conversations, so I don't know why. One thing is probably speed.
Money. You
know, and
they're
cheaper. Trying to maximize web traffic and no, yes, younger reporters obviously are cheaper. But one thing is that I've noticed is, you know, you have people who this is their, you know, second or third job. sometimes it's the first time they've covered a beat,
Yes.
and I think that's I just I don't think that's a recipe for success, doing it that way. I still think it's a beat where you need, because you need to be the ultimate generalist and have some expertise. I can go deep on national security and foreign policy because I covered that for a long time. I can go deep on, when they're dealing with Congress. So, but I can also be a generalist, and I don't see that level of expertise. And one reason is a lot of folks, after covering 4 years of Trump, were just tired. They were worn out. They were just intellectually and emotionally spent, and they wanted to go do other things. And I'm wondering what the press corps might look like, if it would need to change, and if organizations would change their White House teams to have a little more experience and a little more heft if Trump wins, because you're gonna need the Jim Acostas and the Brian Karams, and some other folks who have left the beat, Eamon Javers from CNBC. You need folks like that if Trump's going to come back, and I am worried what that might look like.
Yeah,
And
so John, what I would add to that is in respect to the question that Brian asked of, are we get covering it right, correctly now? I would say I agree with you 100% about post election were he to win, but I think one of the reasons that it is not being covered properly now is because those seasoned veteran reporters who understand history and have been there before. Can say, whoa, wait a minute. Do you realize that? And put in context or in sort of the in refrain from the other candidates what the person is saying. If they're hearing something for the very first time in their lives, and they can't say, well, this is like, Woodrow Wilson in 14, in 1914, or Joe McCarthy in 30 in the 50s, or something. And this is what this portend, they can't do that. I remember when I was an expert in money laundering when I was at the Justice Department, then later as a consultant. I went to a concert, a conference, and some young reporter who was, I think, for the Wall Street Journal or something, was talking about new techniques in money laundering. And he gave this nice speech about new techniques in money laundering. And I was sitting next to somebody who, like me, had been doing this for 30 years. And I said that the only thing that was new of those techniques was it was new to him, because these techniques have been here for 30 years. It was just new to him. So he gives this speech. Wow, this is really interesting. They're putting drugs and money in cargo containers and taking them across the border. This trade-based money laundering is a new phenomenon. I think like, I was prosecuting cases like that in the 1970s. We're now 2000, and it was new to him, and that's what's going on, I think, with these reporters. It's new to them, and they don't know how to say, "I'm sorry, but we saw this. We saw this in Munich. We saw this in the Treaty of Versailles. We saw this,
It's been around a while.
Anyway."
So, on that wonderful note, let's take a short break. When we come back, Michael's going to update us on Trump's nefarious court cases. So, stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, Just Ask the Question podcast listeners. If you've got a second, head on over to Twitter and follow our official page, JATQ Podcast. That's JATQ Podcast.
In this modern age of misinformation and deceit, Just Ask the Questions newsletter cuts through the BS and gets to the truth with Brian's in-depth articles, columns, and exclusive content not found anywhere else. Get the scoop and stay in the know. Sign up for the Just Ask the Question newsletter now at substack.com/JATQ podcast.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Caron, with our weekly review of the news, Just Ask the Press. With us always is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call, John T. Bennett. And Michael, well, We've got four cases for Donald Trump in felonious cases, 91 felonies in four different jurisdictions, plus the civil cases that he's appealed. He put up a bond to appeal the defamation. But see if you can update us a little bit on what's going on in the Supreme Court case. And of course, in the big case coming up is the Bragg case in Manhattan. So it's all yours.
Okie dokie. So this past week, a couple of things happened, or in the past, you know, 9 days or something, a couple of things have happened. One, the Supreme Court rules sort of 9-0 in favor of Trump staying on the Colorado ballot.
Yes.
And the way they answer the question is to say that if individual states could one by one make decisions about who can appear on national elections, then there would be chaos. And that is something that nine justices said cannot be. There was sort of a 5-4 split with all the women on the court being in the four and all the remainders on the five. And those...
Are you calling men remainders?
Yes. Yes. They can be found in the remainder aisle.
That's right.
The female justices, while they were concurring in the 9-0 part of it, what they said, yes, that's right. We agree with that. However, you went further than you needed to, meaning you said, and oh, by the way, the only way that this can occur is if Congress passes legislation and a process is created by Congress. What they were saying is that wasn't an aspect of this case that you needed to decide. You, the majority of five, needed only to decide that we couldn't kick him off for the reasons that were articulated in the lawsuit. And you gave us some sort of gratuitous language, and we don't buy into that. And so we'll see what that means for future cases. But the headline news is 9-0 Trump stays on the ballot. And, you know, we have to read that case in conjunction with the immunity case, which will be argued sometime in the week of April 22. And if they say in that decision that Trump does not have immunity and can go to trial, that I think is a fine outcome, that he's not kicked off the ballot, right, but he has to stand trial before the election. We'll see what happens in that immunity case. It's anything but clear how the court will resolve it. Then we also had hearings in Georgia, final closing arguments in the effort to get Fannie Willis and Nathan Wade, the prosecutors in the Georgia RICO case, thrown off the case. And the judge took it under advisement, will issue a ruling, he said, within the next 2 weeks. And I think it's going to come down to the standard the judge applies. If the judge says there has to be an actual conflict, you have to have profited in some way, did something that is tangible, they don't get kicked off. If the judge says, you know, that's nice, but if they engage in behavior that creates the appearance of conflict, and that's not acceptable in a case like this, so I'm going to ask them to step aside. You could get a decision where they are asked to step aside for appearance reasons, even if actually they didn't commit perjury or actually they didn't profit.
That would benefit Donald Trump,
the case. It will and will not. If they get thrown off the case, but the office of the district attorney is allowed to remain on the case, then changing the attorneys won't make a difference. Because one, Nathan Wade, reputed to be a good lawyer, but not the strongest RICO lawyer in the office or in available. So it's no great loss there. And Fannie Willis has really just been a cheerleader from the sidelines. She may have been involved in the investigation of the case, but she doesn't appear to be part of the trial team. She's not ever been at counsel table. And if she's not, if she wasn't intending to be part of the trial team, then those who are part of the trial team will just continue without her, and she just won't be able to. It's like
Right.
in a baseball game. I keep going back to baseball today because I was in spring training a while ago when I was dealing with my mother's estate.
What position you
If
playing?
the manager gets kicked out of the game, if the baseball manager gets thrown out of the game, and the bench coach has to take over, I expect that the data doesn't support that the team being coached by the bench coach collapses and the team goes on to lose because the manager got kicked out. I think that that for me is a fair analogy. So the manager may get kicked out, but the bench coach is there and can carry on and decide, you know, whether to bunt or steal or hit and run or whatever. The last case is that we have time to talk about is Bragg. He's the DA in New York. He's going to trial shortly in like 2 weeks' time, I think, or
Yeah.
2 weeks' time against Donald Trump for failing to disclose truthfully that he paid money to Stormy Daniels to hush her up from telling her story just before the election, and used Michael Cohen as a cutout in this fraud scheme. I think the facts of that case are strong that that's exactly what he did. He used Cohen as a cutout and then lied on his books about why Stormy Daniels was paid and why Michael Cohen was repaid. The question is a legal one, which is these are misdemeanors. They were charged as felonies and they were involving a federal election. And so the question might be, can you take two misdemeanors, add them together and get a felony? And can New York state law apply to a federal election when it seems to have been written to apply to a state election? So you got some legal issues, legal hurdles for them to overcome. But I think if those are resolved favorably in the DA's case, in the DA's way, then I think the facts of that case are pretty strong because there's nothing that explains what he did other than fraud.
John, and what he did other than fraud, that kind of defines all of Donald Trump's public existence, does it not?
It does. I want to ask Michael a question. As far as the judge in the Georgia case, hearing the Fani Williams and Fani Willis, excuse me, and Mr. Wade allegations, what if one or both of them, and they were both under oath in a courtroom in his courtroom, and I think that's important. What if he determines that one or both of them either lied, misled, or withheld information from him? Well, how does he think about that as a judge? And if they lied under oath during these hearings, should that factor into his decision?
I think two things. First is the case should be referred. Whether if they were to have engaged in provable lies in his courtroom, then one, it should be referred to the Georgia District Attorney's office. Another one, it wouldn't be that office. Someone else would have to step in because they would be recused, obviously, to determine whether or not they should be prosecuted for perjury. Second, it should be referred to the Bar Ethics Committee to determine whether they should have their license revoked. And then third, he'll have to make a determination. This is this question of whether he says, given this, I think that you need to step off of this case. And I think all the first two are for sure within his referral powers. The third is, I think if he determined that they lied in front of his courtroom, I think that he can say to them, I'm excusing you from appearing before me. You see, in the ordinary course, it's not the district attorney and it's not a outside special counsel. So if a line AUSA, a line district attorney, did that, the judge would be on the phone in a nanosecond calling the U.S. attorney or calling the district attorney and saying, "Hey, look, you got a young lawyer in here who just lied to me. Get him the hell off of my out of my courtroom. And by the way, I'm making these referrals." But because it's an independent lawyer, Wade, and the DA, I'm not sure exactly how that process works, John, but I think it's if they committed perjury in his courtroom, I don't see how he lets them continue on in the case. I wouldn't if I had a mechanism available.
Yeah, I don't think he could allow it, right?
If I had a mechanism available to me, I would. And, you know, if I were one of those lawyers and a judge said, I'm referring you to the bar and I'm referring you to the DA for prosecution purposes, I don't think I can say I will stay here anyway, because I don't see how that would be in the interests of my client, meaning the state of Georgia, to have me there, because the judge wouldn't believe anything I'd say.
Right.
Yeah, but McAfee, the judge, he worked for Fannie Willis. He was in that office, I believe.
Right.
So that's another complicating factor. If he believes that she's not a liar, but she's prone to hyperbole, then he might say, look, this is not a lie. This is just, you know, letting Trump be Trump, or, you know, something.
Letting Trump be Trump. And on that wonderful note, we'll take another short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the Super Tuesday fallout and avoiding the shutdown and a lot more. So stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. We're talking to you, and we need your help. As you probably know, independent journalism is a vital pillar of our democracy. Like everything else, it's not free. We're asking all longtime listeners of the show to help support us by becoming a member on Patreon. For the price of a latte, you can help guard democracy. Join us today at patreon.com/JATQ podcast to help us keep bringing you the podcast you love and the facts you deserve.
Hi, we are back. It is Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karen, with our week in review of the news. Just Ask the Press, as usual. With me is former federal prosecutor Michael Zeldin and editor-at-large from CQ Roll Call, John Bennett. And John, when we left, we were talking about the, we were talking about Trump's court cases, which didn't seem to hurt him none come Super Tuesday, when he wiped out all of his competition and even Nikki Haley took her ball and went home, and leaving just Donald Trump standing. There's no one left, is there? There's no one left in the Republican Party that isn't MAGA. And I'll go back to what was it that you had sent earlier? Senator Lisa Murkowski last week asked rhetorically whether the Senate should, quote, just not even exist as a Senate if we have to ask permission for our vote. So nothing left but MAGA anywhere. John, how's this portend for the future? We haven't even had the conventions yet, and we're down to two. It seems to me like that's the most odd accomplishment of my lifetime. This is one long, extended campaign, is it not?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I believe I had this, by the way. I believe I told you guys that Trump would wrap this thing up around Super Tuesday, and there would be nobody left standing. And the incredible thing since Tuesday, Super Tuesday, Super Duper Tuesday, as we know it now, is watching the party coalesce so quickly. Mitch McConnell, the next morning, the Senate Minority Leader, who Donald Trump calls an old crow, who Donald Trump says about Mitch McConnell's wife, Elaine Chao, who was Trump's transportation secretary, and he said nothing but great things about her then. She's an Asian American, and Trump refers to her as Coco Chow. It doesn't get much more racist than that. But Mitch McConnell, the next morning, endorses Donald Trump. And Chris Sununu, the governor of New Hampshire, who was basically a never Trumper, well, he's not a never Trumper anymore. He endorsed Donald Trump last week as well. Yeah. So it's just incredible to see what's happened. And Senator Lisa Murkowski is, I guess we can call her a moderate, because the party's moved so far to the right. And, you know, she's gettable on these these bipartisan efforts, the gun bill, the border package that was pulled, things like that. And she voted to convict Trump in, I believe, the second impeachment trial, the January 6th. So she says that she can't vote for Trump in the general election. She didn't say she might write in. She didn't specify. I don't think she's going to vote for Joe Biden, but
who knows?
She did say this week, you know, looking, you know, talking about the border package and other things, we know, I know from my own reporting that Trump is on the phone with Republican lawmakers in the House and Senate constantly. He works that phone all the time. He called him up on the border package that was emerging, a bipartisan deal with the White House, Senate Democrats and Republicans, and Trump called Republican senators who were inclined to support it and told them not to because that's the basis of his campaign, one of them anyway, and they followed orders, and the border package was pulled from an emergency national security spending bill that the Senate passed and has died in the House. And Murkowski's point is, if we're just going to, as Senate Republicans, do Trump's bidding and not support things that we are inclined to support that we think are good policies, good ideas, what's the point of even having a Senate? And I think that's a fair question to ask right now. You know, you've got Lindsey Graham, who, yeah, at his core supports the border package. He would still like to see that entire bill be passed, if not with the border part, without it. And he's floating the idea of the Ukraine part to be turned into a loan, like Lend-Lease, you might remember that.
Right.
A loan to Ukraine that eventually they could pay back, or you could put language in the bill saying we could just forget the whole thing down the road. It's a creative way to maybe get the Ukraine aid passed. It'll give the House Republicans a little bit of cover. But you have Lindsey Graham saying the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, is going to bring this up with Trump and try to sell him on it. So they can't, they are now completely beholden to Trump. Any idea they have to run by him. And, you know, that's not how Congress is supposed to work. And, you know, it's not supposed to be just one person. There are 435 members of Congress. And so, you know, this is supposed to be deliberative and have a lot of voice and have a lot of compromise. Well, when I think Donald Trump, the last word I think of usually is compromise. And this is not how the Congress is supposed to function. And yet here we are.
And here we are. Where are we, Michael?
Everybody knows this is nowhere.
Yeah. We're going back to the 60s. There's a deep dive.
Yeah, people can look it up. Neil Young, Crazy Horse, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. But what, do you think there's any hope in hell? I mean, we're talking about the GOP. Is there any hope in hell that there will be a GOP post-Trump? Or is it just going to be a MAGA party?
I think if Trump loses, then it empowers the Murkowskis of the world to try to reassert the old Republican Party. What's so disappointing is not so much that Mitch McConnell would endorse Trump. He said, look, I'm an old Republican. I endorse Republicans no matter what, which I think is feeble. But the Sununus of the world, because that I think is unfortunate. You'd hope that they would say something better than I just endorse him after speaking about why, in Sununu's case, the Haley candidacy mattered and what she represent mattered, in sharp refrain from what Trump is talking about. And then to turn around and to say, well, because he received the party's nomination, a party man, and I'm with him. I just don't buy it. I think it's a big fat cop out.
Fat being the operative word, cop out being the headline. There's a lot more we could discuss, but I'm going to divert it for just a second here as we come towards the end of the broadcast and ask everybody, today we turn back daylight savings time. Ramadan begins tomorrow, but tonight it's the Academy Awards. So just the best picture. We got American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, Barbie, The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Past Lives, Poor Things, and The Zone of Interest. All right, Michael, who do you think's, what's the best picture?
Well, I haven't seen any of them, so it's hard to say which one I like the best, but the critics seem to be putting the smart money on Oppenheimer. And the question there is, will it match Titanic and I think Lord of the Rings or something as only movie to garner 11 awards? So wow. That's where the smart money is, even though that movie is way too long for me.
Yeah.
And more fiction than fact. But
there you go. How about you, John?
Well, I know that Oppenheimer, I haven't seen any of these films. Jeez.
Good Lord, I've seen them all. That's
I will
say. But you've got way more time on your hands, Carol. Right. John and I actually are working for a living.
The Academy likes to make political statements in recent years, and I believe if there is, and I don't know anything about these films, really. I know Oppenheimer, obviously. If there is a left-leaning message in one of these films, I'll pick that one.
Well, I take it back. I haven't seen Anatomy of a Fall. I've seen the rest of them, and was forced to on a couple of them. But I loved The Holdovers and Killers of the Flower Moon. But I think Oppenheimer, for its scope, is just the favorite to walk away with it. And that's, well, as we come to a close, plug away what you would like, Michael.
So my podcast is That Said with Michael Zeldin on all podcasts, apps. I just released this week my interview with Katie Couric about her life in media and outside of media. Really, I thought, enjoyable interview. And then I've got other ones coming up. My next one, I think, is a book called Flirting with Danger, about the first woman spy in the World War I era.
Wow.
So have a listen. Her name was Marguerite Harrison.
There you go. John, are you ready to make that wonderful announcement, or are we going to put it off?
I will do that next week. We'll do that next
Okay.
week. Another busy week ahead on Capitol Hill and in Washington, and we'll have President Biden on the road a lot this week after the State of the Union. He's hitting some swing states to try to sell his message one more time. And you know, they feel like they've got some momentum. The White House does. And we'll see by his campaign. We'll see about that. He'll be in Wisconsin and Michigan, New Hampshire. He's already been in Georgia. You can follow along with that. There's another government funding deadline. That's fun. This is the harder one of the two that they set up for themselves. It's a multi-bill package. This is the tougher one. We'll see if they can get across the finish line or if part of the government shuts down. And that's a long way of saying you can follow all this fun at rollcall.com.
There you go. The name of this podcast is called Just Ask the Question. I am your host, Brian Karam. Thanks for joining us, and we will catch you next week. Same bat time, same bat channel.